and to live here and to work here. In terms of the tuition grants program, then that's a whole other area, of course. And we have some problems right now that I have to look into that I really am not prepared to address in terms of our tuition grants program. Because I have some legal questions on that in certain instances.
But are you saying, regardless of student loans, that seems super generous to you, that incentive to come back with 50%?
I think if you look around the country, that we have here one of the more generous loan programs and forgiveness programs that you'll find.
Well, I have some thoughts on the student loan program. I think the way that it's currently constructed, that some of the comments that were made in Fairbanks were very reasonable comments. I think that if there were going to be some modifications, if the system were modified so that students could only receive a loan to leave the state for educational programs which were not offered in the state, and that if it were for graduate work, that a requirement, one of the requirements be that they do their undergraduate work within the state of Alaska in order to receive funds for education in another state in a particular program, graduate program, which is not offered in Alaska, and that they could receive a student loan to go out of state for their undergraduate work if their undergraduate work were tied directly to a particular field which was not offered in the state of Alaska, so that it would answer some of the complaints that we heard in Fairbanks, the basic one being that it was discouraging people from participating in higher education in Alaska, which I think in some instances would certainly be the case. And at the same time, this would provide the opportunity for the student to receive higher education in any field that he or she chose, but would not be detrimental to the public education systems in the state, and it would encourage people to stay in the state.
Is there a question to that, John?
Well, that's one that we've really been around the bush on before, and I have to say that I'm pretty much in disagreement with you, although some of my constituents in Fairbanks probably wouldn't like what I'm saying. The student forgiveness, I'm 100% for. But if you, how can you compare your final degree in electronic engineering from the University of Alaska from MIT? The man who can get in and finish up in MIT or something. And it isn't just things where wishing or whammy is offered in the other programs, but a good example is electronics engineering from MIT. If he can finish up there, you should help him to finish up with that kind of a degree. Hopefully our own university will have made the background for it. If it hasn't, let him have his MIT degree. Or the same with the man who ends up, well, it isn't so true in the law degree, because I guess that isn't offered in Alaska. But it is true in electronics engineering. It's certainly true in some other things. I believe there's some place where you're better off in mining. I don't know whether it's Mobile or Colorado or where it is. You end up with the top work. And to bring him back to the state and forgive him something when he gets back there so that he brings his expertise back there, I'd sooner have him back there with an MIT degree, even though he got most of it in Alaska, or part of it in Alaska, than I would to lose him after he's dead. I think that it has a tendency to be a bucket of worms.
I would like to see it looked at also in terms of the length of time that it takes to pay it back. The way it's written right now, if you used every option that you have in there, you could almost go for something like 7 years without starting a payment.
Right.
So for all purposes, with inflation the way it is, by the time you start paying it back, that 40% isn't worth 5%. And so the smart ones, and a lot of them are doing this, I don't know if you had a chance to look to see how few are paying back yet. But there are a number of them that aren't paying back and have not even been billed or approached.
But, well, they're starting to bill now.
Yeah.
And then, of course,
I think they can declare poverty for one period of time, and they can declare something else, and there are about five different declarations that could be compounded.
That's right.
And that could be tightened up so we start getting that money back into it. And I think we did something last year when we
get
the money back into the revolving fund rather than back into the general.
And there's also another thing that is being undertaken right now, which quite frankly I'm surprised it's just now being undertaken as their billing procedure is finally being formalized and put this, as I say, it surprised me that that it wasn't formalized in a manner that people were automatically billed when they ceased to be a student. They start receiving bills, and that there were records kept in terms of alerting the staff of the loans and tuition department there that this person is ready now to be billed and to follow up on them. This is put on data processing now. We're in the process, and hopefully when I get back, I'll be able to see the test runs on it, and they're getting everyone on a system now whereby the billing will be automatic, and hopefully that will improve things greatly. Another thing that I should point out, that if you're aware of it, fine. If you're not, you should be, and that is that there has never been any attempt at collection, and I asked about this specifically because of what I read in the paper, and there has never been any attempt at collection or follow-up. When our agency mails a letter, if they don't get any reply, they check with a parent if they have the address, and if not, that's it. And there's never been any follow-up on it. And there will come a time, maybe we haven't reached that yet, because we don't know the magnitude of the default rate. You asked me about that? No, I have no idea. And amazingly enough, and unfortunately enough, neither does the loan and tuition section. I asked them about defaults, and they couldn't tell me either. This is one of the things we'll get out of this system, finally. And there will undoubtedly come a time when default rates reach a certain magnitude where it will be advisable to pursue collections in a more vigorous manner.
One of the things that happened when they set this up, which I think was very unfortunate, is that all that was put into the computer was this sending out the bills business. And in the meantime, there's no record of the loans that are being made and who's getting the loans and the schools they're going to. And this is very unfortunate because there's a lot of information that we should be able to pull off the computer for the benefit of the awarder of the grants, namely the state. And we'll probably be asking for money to do something more with this program to make it more valuable to the state.
And I have several other comments, too. Another one is, in the actual process of application and making the judgment on the application, I don't think that those judgments have been sound judgments up to this point. Now, I don't know how you're going to manage this. What I think really is a problem at this point is that Mr. Crothers couldn't possibly handle anything he had to handle. And they aren't being made. I've seen several of the students where they're requesting a certain amount, they're telling what they have to go either inside or outside the state. There hasn't been too much inquiry into what their financial capabilities are on their own. Not that I think that we should have to change this.
I would like to talk to the committee sometime at length about this, and I'm going to say this so that Terry doesn't have to, he hasn't been there really to watch what's going on, and I've been sitting up there all summer. The program is not really functioning, and neither is Mr. Crothers.
That's right.
Mr. Crothers is not functioning, and it's a sad fact of life.
Now, I have another recommendation. I think that if the statistics that were given us in Fairbanks are correct, and if I'm not mistaken, it was something like last year, something like 2 million went outside the state and about 1 million stayed in. I would hate to see us limit the options of students to go outside, because I think it's very valuable for a student to spend a couple of years out. We're finding more and more of them go out their first year and they come back.
Right.
They're coming back their second, third, and fourth year because they've had the year out that they have to have. And so we're not losing, we're coming back. But is there any way we could do it where we could say that no more than one third of our money could go outside the state? Could this be done so we could keep more of it?
I'm not sure. I don't know where they got those figures, really. And I'm not sure that the student loan can tell you.
Validate those.
Right.
I asked them to substantiate them. They couldn't. So I don't know where they got them.
I don't either. But if that's the case, it's sad.
From the management
budget
audit. Budget audit. That's what I understand. It's on the tapes.
I'm going to have to disagree with my esteemed senior colleague from Fairbanks. I go along with him claim about sending people this money outside the state and these students outside, but I would say one qualification. You simply said whether there is a program. Now, I would say whether we have an adequate program. And frankly, I've been thinking about that, and deciding that the best people...
Yeah,
I'm coming to that. But the only people that the legislature can turn to say, is this program adequate, let's say, in a particular field, is going to be the 1202 Commission. They're the ones who should be able to tell us. Well, that's right. University is obviously not objective about its own programs. If it thought a program is inadequate, they wouldn't have it, right? It would do something about it. So they can't be objective, but the post-secondary commission, however, should be, and I would say in Alaska, not just University of Alaska, but if AMU or Sheldon Jackson or the university, any one of them, has an adequate program, then we shouldn't pay people to go outside and study in Colorado.
Well, there are also some people who can go outside and stay with relatives for nothing, or for very little, you know, and get a much cheaper education than by going, if they do not live in Anchorage or Fairbanks, than by going to Anchorage and Fairbanks and having to pay board room. And I think you have to consider special situations, too, so that it doesn't work a hardship.
Yeah, but you also have to consider the fact that if $2 million, I'll say if $2 million a year is going outside for students to study outside, and let's say you cut this in half, right? You've got $1 million more to improve our programs in the state. And if we improve them, maybe the students can get a quality education here. But if they've got to go outside because the funding is so niggardly that they can't have a decent program, which, right?
It's a chicken and egg type of thing is what we're into right now.
The thing that we discovered, that it was a real political potboiler, and we can't win it.
It is something I think we have to, you have to get a toehold on before we can do anything. I have some material right now down in Legislative Affairs for experiential grants. They're doing this now in North Carolina, they're doing it in Virginia. Some places they call it social service internships, other they call it experiential education. It's similar to the cooperative year education or year for action. And Mr. McAtee talked to me at this some length and gave me a lot of material. And since I couldn't get with this group, I'd like to think it could go in through the Higher Education Committee. I took it down to Ann Carbonetti, asked her to do some research on it and draw something up. Or I'm not sure who has it at this point. What it could do is it could take a certain amount of this funding and put it into grants. Now, that means that an experiential grant would have to be within the state. It would bring the employers into higher education is what it would do. It means that a student maybe in a senior year or junior year could have a whole year where he works with an employer and he is funded through this particular process and get a full year's credit for it. They have their on-campus instructor and then they have their instructor or adjunct professor who serves within this place where they work. It's a good guideline for education for people who feel that this is a good way to educate the students, which I do. But I'm having it drawn up now, and I'd like to think we could take a look at it and see if maybe that's a way of keeping it in the state, keeping a new trend in education going, and maybe making it a grant rather than a loan.
Carrie, who is the person legislative affairs who's called you?
That's Jerry Williams. But I thought that was a community service program whereby a student accrued time and dollars for time served that could be drawn back against when he went into education.
That is the way I explained it to him.
Okay, well.
But he may be a fine.
I have a lot of material I haven't read on it yet.
Uh-huh, right.
Well, who would administer this, 1202?
Yeah, I had to put under the 1202.
I'd really agree. I'm interested in it, but there's one thing about it, and this is what I fear is going to happen unless it's very carefully administered, and that is that a lot of employers are going to just use it to get cheap help. That's exactly what happened with the WIN program, for example, or things of this sort, where you have where the state, somebody's paying an employer, subsidizing an employee to work with an employer. So that theoretically, the person earns a job and then can go on. But a lot of employers have used that just to get cheap help. They've hired somebody for half a year.
Isn't this for community service personnel?
It could be community service, it could be social service, they call it different things in different places.
Right.
I'd like to think it would be broad scope, but it wouldn't be just social services.
When you said employer, well, you didn't mean private business, then.
Sure.
Well, okay, that's what I'm...
See, I didn't have that...
That's exactly the point, see?
I thought it was anything but private business.
Oh, sure, no.
Instead of paying somebody $1,000 a month, let's say you get them for $600 because somebody else is picking up the tab for $400 and at the end of that time...
You can always put it on a matching basis.
You get some cheap help, you don't teach them
anything. See, we already have it from a federal level. Year for Action does this, but that's federal monies. Co-op year does the same type of thing, except the employer pays the whole amount. For instance, I have 5 co-op year students working in my program. We pay them. Action doesn't pay a thing for them. But we serve as adjunct professors, and they get a full year of credit. and they do things which are meaningful. So this is the type of thing that I'd like to see.
How would this be different from what you're talking about?
This would be more like the year for action, because the money would be coming from the state, and the federal money is going to phase out.
Okay.
Whereas the one I'm doing right now, I'm furnishing the money for the students under co-op year. That's the way it's operated.
Even under UIA, there is a matching.
There's a matching under UIA.
I understand you propose to take the, not to have the program on its own merits, but to take the money from the, part of the money from the loan program and divert it into this?
Could be.
Okay, may I register my strong opposition to it, in spite of my respect for you, Dr. Kern? Because the student loan program is not overfunded. I maybe can support the other program, but to take the money from the student loan program for it, I'd have to oppose it. I don't want to oppose
the program. That's nothing in the bill. That was a question I threw out. There's nothing in this legislation. I didn't even mention the loan program when I asked them to work this up. I gave them the information and asked them to work up something which would be this type of a program. No, that was just a comment I made that maybe it could become, that'd be a way of keeping it in the state. It'd be a way of keeping, bringing the business community into education. There are a lot of very neat things that can happen with a program like this.
But it could be separate, totally
sure,
separate.
It could be totally separate.
Well, if we can get a law school, then we can have half the lawyers in the states getting our work done off of public funds. If we can get a law school started, that'll be a great one.
Well, that's something, as I understand, that's left open. It could be matching. It could. You didn't set up any particular financial arrangements for it.
As a matter of fact, I just turned it over to him, told him what I thought might work, and then hoped that we could take it on as a group and look at it and say, does it look good or doesn't it? Because it'd be more meaningful if it were worked out through the 1202.
Before you went to see Jerry Williams.
Yeah.
I'm glad to also, I'm sure that Carrie will be keeping an eagle eye on our program, so the student is actually learning something and not just furnishing cheap help for somebody for a period of a year.
It would have to be, of course. But that would be a responsibility for the legislation that's being brought together, and then the administration would come through.
There's one other thing that you mentioned earlier. We also have an advisory council for the student aid section. I have not met with them yet. As the commission is set up, I sit as the executive secretary of that group, or something on that group. And we haven't called them together yet. And when we do so, would you like us to explore this possibility? Not the one you're talking about here. I'm talking about the possibility of setting a limit, a percentage, restricting out-of-state portion as opposed to in-state. Should we look at that? Is it something that you feel we should look at?
It might be worth it. It might answer some of those objections that make mollify them more to the program as it now runs.
We're considering, we are going to have our commission meeting the 6th and 7th of February. And we're considering having a meeting of this, if we can get the funding, having a meeting of the Student Loan Advisory Committee at that same time, while we have Walt Furness on hand, who is going to be one of the two
Mike Miller has a bill in right now, you know, that would give 100% forgiveness for those who stayed in Alaska. And for all purposes, that's what they're getting right now, you know. But I was opposed to that last year. I felt that was discrimination against those going outside. But the more testimony I've heard, the more I think that if we're going to... Maybe this is an answer.
Something else that had been mentioned, not here, but had been mentioned, was the possibility of keeping a loans program for those students leaving the state and setting up a grants program, an outright grants program for those to stay in the state. Mm-hmm. And in fact, then you could tap a small amount, because of the student base in the state, but a small amount of federal funds under the state student incentive grants program, where they would match dollar for dollar up to whatever the limit for the state is. Outright grants to students. But then you're also talking about incorporating some kind of measurement of need and some other things that the loan program doesn't really look at as prescribed by the federal government.
But in that would come under your aegis then, about regulating that. That's already thrown in your lap, so it's a way.
Right.
Then you, if you came up with those proposals, you would have to put them to the legislature for us to modify the law on that.
Definitely.
And you'd have to recommend, and that's be up to us to answer.
Right.
Yeah. Now, one other question that came up in regards to these was this two-year residency. Do you all recall all the objections they had to that? And that may be, I think it was for tuition grants as well as loans. And that's a trouble spot. And I don't know what other states do, but here, with this pride in being an Alaskan and not just coming and going real fast, and that they want to be sure that those are true Alaskans.
I don't know what, you know, that residency business is something else again.
Mm-hmm. That was called into question.
Yeah, but courts have held that a university may charge a higher out-of-state tuition and so forth
right.
than it does for its own residents. That's been held by the courts already.
Okay.
Excuse me, I'm sorry, I think this business would be a, there would be a parallel thing here.
The question is the period of time.
The period
how do you
of time
define?
Is the question.
That's been challenging.
It'll be the period of time, you know. If you can run for a representative in the state and be there less than a year, or a senator in the state and be there less than a year,
you
got to
be in 30 days.
That's what I said.
To be a voter.
Well,
did you have a comment, David, on that?
That's, I was just going to say, if I might take a second, that that's not an area that I would want you, as a matter of fact, I was trying to keep you from proceeding into without letting us look very closely at it, because durational residence is not the question as far as whether you can have a resident, non-resident differentiation, mm-hmm. but any durational residency is under for voting, running for office, everything that their state has to involve in.
Yeah, but there's no that once you define residency somehow, there's no not much question whether the state can differentiate between residence and non-residence in some areas like this.
There's no question at all that the state can do it. The test, the court cases that I'm familiar with have gone off generally on the theory of what is necessary for administrative purposes to determine whether or not the person is a resident. Anything that from what I look at, have looked at, and I'm certainly not the latest word on it or the last word, but I would suggest that anything over a 30-day durational residence would be viewed with suspicion. It would be one of those things. You might stand up to it. It might be a good reason, but it comes without.
I mean, it could be challenged in the courts any time.
Oh, certainly. What I'm saying is that I wouldn't want to recommend any residency over durational residency over 30 days.
May I just say that it was challenged in Arizona. They had a one-year residency, and the state did win that, and they upheld that they could require 1 year. And in terms of defining resident out and non-resident tuition basis, depending on the criteria they had, and they had certain criteria that you had to be a resident, taxpaying, and a number of things, for 1 year, and it was upheld. Now, it didn't go on to the Supreme Court, though. Stopped at the state level.
Right. I just suggest that that's something that many council look into. If you get seriously into this area, let's look at it.
Yeah, but let's take one step farther, though, Dave. Another point is that, you know, we can go ahead and do things and then let somebody challenge it in court. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just like this Alaska hire bit. So we've now the constitutionality is being challenged. Which is a little, you know, it's kind of after the fact. You know, we may win or lose on it, but nevertheless, it's the same deal. We went ahead and did it, you know, and if somebody challenges, we worry about that at that time.
I think that's true. I would just hope that with good legal counsel, you could write it.
We could word it in a good legal way that it would be very hard to challenge.
That's
right.
That's what I
Well, I think the objections, if I remember, Charlie, were that they objected to 2 year rather than one. Nobody did bring up 30 days. They were hoping we could turn it back to 1 year. That's what I remember as the major objection, because it made an undue hardship on people who just weren't eligible.
Well, that young lady who spoke in Fairbanks and was very happy because she didn't get a student loan. She'd only been up here a year from New York or someplace, and I felt it was New York's responsibility to give her a student loan, not ours. And I still feel the same way. That may be chauvinistic, that's the way I feel, you know.
There are other loan sources, too, of course.
Well, I'm simply saying, I don't think the state of Alaska has an obligation to send somebody out to pay somebody to go out to study in Colorado when the person just came here from New York last year. That's just carrying a little bit far.
No, particularly when we take good care of ours who are going outside of school, right, Charlie?
First,
if there was
some kind of
good care. Was that question that came up in Arizona have to do with this kind of student loan requirement, or was it something else?
Oh, no, that was another thing. Arizona has no state support in tuition, loan, scholarship, in any form. One of two states in the union now.
They have no state support, and then they have a duration.
Well, for charging fees. That's
what about tuition at their state schools?
Oh, they have tuition. They do not have, it's tuition free in the community college system, but they certainly have it in the university system.
Okay, that's another...
Oh, I'd like to talk to you more about that, but that's
yeah,
what the... That's,
that's an area that was recommended in their proposals, too.
It's, you know, the absolute tuition-free in the community college isn't... With New York going down the drain because of free education, I just didn't know.
And the university...
I don't think that was their total problem.
I think there were other kind of things, too.
Well, the other thing that came up in the academic development plan was that that recommends free tuition for university students.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And then the McLean proposals recommended for community college. Did they recommend it across the board in that academic
plan?
Yes, they did.
They
from
said
everybody. And the McLean proposal said just for community colleges, so that's where you differ.
No,
yeah, I differ on that.
You were already...
Well, you different in the time sequence.
No, I didn't even differ in the time sequence. What I said was we were asked to look at that particular issue. We studied that particular issue, and our recommendation was the tuition. The issue was should community college tuition be free? And the answer, the conclusion that we arrived at was yes, it should. I also said that I suspect that if we studied universities' tuition structure, and depending on the temper of the climate at that time, that we probably would have recommended that the university's tuition be free also. But there's more of a philosophical question here which has to be answered, and that is, how much emphasis does the state of Alaska as a whole want to put on higher education for its people?
And how much can
you afford
in the next couple of years?
That's just emphasis, but yeah.
Is this the time? Is this the time to make that pitch?
If you like.
Just the one that I believe that 14 years of basic education should be provided by the state instead of 12. Just that simple thing.
Yeah, well, I'd be happy to.
That takes in community college levels.
First 2 years of any university?
First 2 years of the university, if you want it. You got 14 years free. And then go on from there. And I think that a person needs, in, at least in this time, it's more complicated to live than it was when the 12-year schedule was brought about. The society is more complex, and I think that that's rather not wild at all to go for 14 years today.
Let me add one other point to that. That is, when looking at the tuition, as a portion of the overall budget of higher education in Alaska, Dr. Belkin's report shows a total of 15%, about 7% on the Fairbanks campus, about 24% on the Anchorage campus of the campus income, which is derived from tuition. I think that that budget does not reflect the overall higher education budget because they only had a total figure of about $26 million in there, and I don't recall right off the top of my head what the appropriation was for higher education overall, but I believe it was somewhere in the neighborhood of $87 or $89 million. Does anyone know?
This year it's going to be close to $100
million. All right, $100 million, and we're talking about a total tuition incomes to the state of $3 million, so we're talking about less than 3% there. Now, if one were, if you had to make some choices as to an either-or situation, I think one choice might be a modification of the student loan program, saving some funds there, and giving free tuition to students who attend Alaska colleges and universities. That's one possibility. On the other hand, if you could afford everything, that would be a good investment by the state.
Not only 14 years, but 18 years.
I would make it free because the amount of expenditure, you're really not talking about all that much money in relation to the overall budget.
Well, then you would have a larger budget because you would have more people attending school if that is what keeps people out of school.
Right. And of course, what your hope is that as these people became more skilled, they would command higher salaries and in turn would pay greater taxes and become more productive members. Is a whole argument following through to the end. But it depends. It's a philosophical question.
At what point do you publicly fund completely the professional student? And how much does a professional student earn toward the real estate product?
It's like it was anything will be abused.
We can normally have a, you know, like progressing toward a degree, isn't that? In that kind of a bill. But I just want to say that you probably compared somewhere in your studies, compared Alaska tuition with other states. And I think, from what I've seen, this state, I was amazed when I came here and looked at the tuition. Higher education in this state is a real bargain for the citizen. And you're right, it's such a negligible part of the budget. I think the reason it is because your tuition rates are so low.
You could go either way.
It came from the old land-grant college. That's where it started from. The land-grant college for residents was tuition-free. And that's where the idea came from. And it, like Topsy, it grew.
And I've always been an advocate of keeping them as low as possible because the state, you know, to try for as much as the state can support to keep the tuition costs as low as possible to the citizens, to encourage everyone who can attend an institution to do so.
Well, I'd like to repeat what I said in Fairbanks because Millie and Carrie weren't here and some of the rest of the people, and that is that I would be, and I will fight tooth and nail against having community college tuition free and charging for it at the university. I think that's a policy decision the state would be making, which would be that it's better for the state and better for the society to have more people go to community colleges and take, generally speaking, let's say, go into vocational type of areas than to go through to places where they have a typical four-year degree leading to other kinds of careers. That's exactly what that would do if you're going, and it's a recommendation were it to be followed, which says community college is free and other ones not.
But I think that 14 years,
I'm simply saying, but this would be the point I'm making, right. is that you would then be encouraging a drain from the four-year campuses to the community colleges. You'd be encouraging people to go into vocationally oriented type things and so forth. And that's a policy decision I'm not sure the state should make at this point.
Well, on the other hand, you would be funneling more people into the community college system who would then go into the four-year programs.
Well, not necessarily. That's what the people in community colleges keep saying. Yeah, they keep saying that, but you go into community college to take a two-year course in office administration, right? And then maybe some of those people will go on to the four-year thing afterwards, but a great number of them who might otherwise have gone through a four-year program will simply go to that two-year program and go out and go to work. Now, if that's a decision the state wants it that way, that's one thing. But, you know, I'm not sure the state has made a decision.
You can also take sociology and psychology and other courses in the community college, too. You're not restricting yourself to just the book.
Why not take a giant step sideways? And that's how I read it. Steve's the way he read it. If we were going to make 2 years of community college free, instead of using that as community college, just add the 2 years so that it'll count whether it's your first 2 years.
I have no objection to what you were saying.
That takes care of your program.
I said I have no objection to what you were saying. I'm simply objecting to a business of making it free at community colleges and still charging it at the university for the four-year campuses.
Let's be sure we cure that by referring to it in years by taking a sideways step there, and then we've eliminated the issue that you brought up, because I'm highly in agreement with your issue that you shouldn't make it free under one name and not free under the other name. And if we refer to it that way, we'll never have a problem.
I know, no trouble with 13th and 14th years. That's no problem.
Well, the problem there arises is that now you made a decision to discourage the 15th or 16th year at the university level, because after all, you're not encouraging it by giving them free tuition. I mean, that's how the argument would go on to its logical end. And you could also, there's another argument, and that is you could say that you're not really discouraging. And this is not an argument that I would make, but there is another argument. You can say what we are encouraging is for students to enroll in institutions which will operate at a lower cost to the state, which therefore in the long run will be cheaper, because community college education will be cheaper than university education. So that's another possible position that someone will take, I'm sure.
Well, I think I might make another distinction. That is, first, what you say is we're encouraging people to be trained rather than educated. That's what I'm concerned about, number one. The second point is that if we had the student loan program still existing, and any student who went through the first 2 years would have a loan program available for the last two, and the standard time sort of to transfer at universities or colleges is after the completion of the second year. Because the first 2 years for not every occupation, or every major, but for the great bulk of them, the first 2 years are pretty common. No matter what you're going to go into, taking pre-law or English or what, you know, the first 2 years are pretty common.
Eric?
Well, that flies in the face of what somebody else said earlier. I don't remember whom, but the number of students go outside for the first, second year and then come back.
So the first 2 years are fairly common no matter which way you go. I mean, anybody will tell you that in the educational field is about this. You go to the University of Alaska or California or Kansas, your first 2 years, most degrees are...
would we be attracting students from outside that way?
Well, it would still be out of state. I would still perceive that out of state tuition would schedule.
I have one concern about the going ahead all the way. It's the same concern that a lot of people are talking about in the way of what we do off of our resource taxation within the period of, let's say we're looking ahead at least to 1980 and the years immediately there beyond. We as a state will have the capability of getting rid of all of our income taxes and everything like that. If we do that, and if we fund the full four-year educational program, free tuition, we will attract people in here to spend our resource money who don't intend to be Alaskans or anything else because of the short durational requirements. And I think we would be, in spite of the fact that I'd like to see the higher education completely free, I think it's just the same thing as removing income tax, that this will be the promised land. Go there and the word will be out. Go to Alaska and you can get it all free. That's fine if they were Alaskans as far as I'm concerned, but we'll attract them, we'll spend the resource monies, we will have built up the expenses of the state, the resource monies will soon be gone.
Yeah, I was going to say, in support of that, one of the legal arguments we lost when I was in Arizona was trying to, and I can foresee something like this here, is we give free tuition all the way up the line. All right, so an out-of-state student comes in, enrolls the first year at a community college out-of-state tuition rate. The second year he's immediately a resident, he gets free tuition the rest of the time. In Arizona, they tried to avoid that resident, non-resident, by saying if you started as a non-resident, you remain a non-resident throughout your schooling, and they sure got bounced out of court on that. So you can't avoid that, and I think you're absolutely right. I think you'd have a lot of people that come in willing to pay that first year tuition, establish residency, and have free tuition the rest of the time, because that's a whale of a bargain.
I was looking at something else. I was looking at it basically on a non-discriminatory basis. If we establish a four-year tuition-free program,
right.
That's what I meant. As much as I like that idea, we will cause students who have no intention of becoming Alaskans even to rush in here from all over. And we will spend our short-term 10 years of, or 13 or 15 years of resource monies on these.
Well, and, if you do this, then I think we would have to charge a more realistic cost for the services that the school provides, like board and room and food, which are now certainly money-losing
propositions.
You can't do that, though, Millie, at least in Fairbanks, which is a place that has the dorms. They just, until this last year of the pipeline, then you had trouble keeping them filled. You know, the students don't want to live on campus.
Well,
those
services aren't so much as the food.
You mean as poor as that food service is, somebody's subsidizing? I'm glad I'm not Fairbanks saying that.
The removal of tuition would remove the argument of the student loan fund encouraging people to leave the state, then. To some degree.
There'd be no necessity for a student loan fund.
Oh, no. No, you'd still need, if the student would want to leave the state, or...
Just for out, not necessarily just for out of state.
Or to be a full-time student, there are a lot of expenses other than tuition, and your tuition is such a small amount, you know, you're not really talking about many dollars. As you pointed out.
So that there isn't any confusion on what I suggest, I was just saying that we maybe should be a little bit moderate because we can attract a bunch of people in here. We could do it just as easy by no income tax, for instance. And actually, we'll be able to provide more if we keep our taxes reasonably on like everybody else does. People won't look for this as a tax-free utopia where you go to school free. As much as I'd like to see the free schooling all the way up, I think that we should use moderation. That's why I've asked for 14 years.
How unique is that there are tuition-free institutions in other states?
It's fairly unique. It's not unique at all at the community college level.
No.
At the university level, I'm unaware of... I'm only two states, New York.
Yes.
City University, University of New York is pretty near.
California's state college system.
No, that's fairly high.
But the university's high.
No, University of California's a low one. California State College system is the one that's relatively high. Although now they're both about equal.
Did the other one manage to bring its parent government into bankruptcy, whoever the second one is?
No.
New York City University. But who else is?
Well, that was a fiasco, but that wasn't there. The economics, trying to compare education there versus here, is, you know, there's just no comparison what the problem is.
Well, it would be ready.
Applied from New York, for instance. She'd worked hard to stay there for 1 year. Now, she's going to stay here, probably, if she can get a loan assistance. But if she can't get the loan assistance, she'll probably go out back outside. And she's one more body, and that's what the university's asking for. You know, the more bodies, the better the program, the more money stays in the state. And so one wonders a little bit about that. If they work hard for a year and fuck the weather and everything else, I think they're entitled.
The other side of that coin is that
you mean Fairbanks is like Siberia? you
got, just like you had about a week ago here, you've got some people out there putting up power lines at 45 below, repairing a broken power line at 45 below in very thick ice fog. And those people are paying the taxes that support this system. And I mean, damn it if I'll ask one of them to pay for somebody from New York to go to school at our expense. We'll not do it.
If they were going to pick up their residence in order to get a tuition loan to go back out to New York, I would object to that. But if we were to do something, because it seems to me it could be written in that if a student comes up from outside, stays for 1 year, they are then entitled to a loan if they stay in the state.
I don't.
But how
can
this work?
I don't think you can do that. I asked the legal counsel. I don't think you can differentiate what the loan program, for instance, you have to be a resident 5 years to qualify as opposed to a 2 year on a grant. I think if you start changing your definition of a resident within the loan program, I think you're in trouble, aren't you?
I would suspect that. I'm certainly have research.
All you can do is you can see the difference between non-resident and resident, all you want to, except you can't set any duration. This is how what a resident is or a non-resident.
Well, the
court says it's in his mind.
Well, yes, and the whole thrust of the Alaska Hire program, John, is not aimed at durational, but aimed at intention, right? They're trying to determine intentions. There are certain things one does which indicate an intention to stay here.
If I'm after a $20,000 education free of charge, I can sure get some honorable or dishonorable intentions in a hurry.
Well, it's a way of getting around a durational thing. That's all you can say for it.
And a post office box.
Well, we'll have our attorneys look into the residency.
Yeah.
I don't know how else to handle that.
We really have to disagree with what it is that we want to look at.
We haven't agreed on that either. And whether we want to cut it back to 1 year or
could I suggest that the loan and scholarship or loan and tuition committee look at this in our meeting that's coming up, and then we will make a recommendation back. And at that time, I think it would be more advisable for you to formulate something.
Is it not that the Attorney General is the statutory legal counsel for the Alaska Coast Secondary
Education? We've got a real question on that.
He is, but unfortunately, you know, it's first come, first served basis, and the request of much advance. So we have in the budget for 77 the request for part of an attorney.
Part of an
adjourn.
Part of an attorney's time. Because with all the regulations that we have to follow with and these very legal questions that are coming up,
When we start dealing with that net, there will probably be a number of legal questions, and we're going to. Right now, I understand. Up until this time, we sort of shared one or.
The Department of Education let us use theirs.
Yeah, and they say they can't do that anymore because we started immediately saying we need. They said, "Oh, you can't have it." So we're going to need to make some arrangement with the Attorney General's office. Yeah.
We sure do.
We don't have it in the budget for it now, and we sure need that.
Can I make a suggestion for a change?
Settle back. Now you've got a chance to study all this and not touch this.
I would appreciate
it. I'd appreciate it.
At least not form an opinion until we have a chance to look at it. That's what I'd like to see.
I think that's what we said last year. Mm-hmm. Wow. What your office said.
Then we weren't. We couldn't even become active in that way.
one other thing is that I don't know if any state that has any more lengthy residency requirement than 2 years. And if you have that on the books now, it hasn't been challenged. The only thing you're talking about is reducing things as opposed to making it longer.
Okay. Well, I don't think you'd find anybody wanting to make it longer than 2 years.
Right.
Because I think you'd be flying in the face of, well, you'd be asking for somebody to take your tour. That's right.
So, but what you want, what you really said, what you, that was not the whole issue, was could, how long can it be in the direction of longer as opposed to shorter? I would say, if anything, you find that it would be, end up shorter than longer than 2 years.
I think there's also a discrepancy between the length of time you have to be resident to be a loan and the length of time you have to be here to get a tuition equalization grant.
Oh, goodness, I hope you're wrong.
Oh, are you sure?
I think one year, one's 2 years, isn't it?
No, because Bob Dalbach was objecting to the 2 year residency because it eliminated a lot of students who might be eligible, who might go there. And he would have preferred a shorter, he said 6 months. It was what he would like, of course. But, you know, if it gets cut back to a year, it would help them and the student tuition grant.
You realize, of course, you would increase your tuition grant program.
That's what I thought.
If you do away with tuition, you would increase your tuition grant program by that proportionate amount that tuition is now charged. Because the legislation, as I understand it, is to not discourage a student that lives in this town, any particular town, from going to the private institution as opposed to the public, and the tuition is supposed to equalize it, so if you eliminate it, you've got to pay it all.
Yes, that's right.
So it'll increase that too. Okay.
Well, wait a minute. We'll back up. You mean if we eliminate tuition, like John was talking about,
right,
like the McLean Report, we would have to pay the full cost to somebody to go to AMU?
No, full tuition cost, yes, sir.
I know.
Yes, sir.
No, I don't think so. I think what we would pay is what the university would have charged. We'd pay the differential between that and the other. But
charge your out-of-state students and
maybe something like that, but to pay simply because AMU wants to charge, say, $1,500 a year. I don't know what they charge, but suppose they pick this amount. We're going to automatically pick up all of that while, you know, because we're paying for free, some people for free to UA.
If they raise their tuition, that could happen.
I have to look at the legislation.
Well, we can change the legislation.
Yes, that's right. I'm sure you'll like it.
Which one?
We're not going to go that route. Someone
about
sure.
all of their tuition over there paid regardless of the cost. See, that'll solve all these problems.
They use tuition equalization thing anyway.
Raise the tuition until it balances the budget? We pay the tuition?
I would like to point out that there is one institution in the state that's receiving tuition grants, not from the state, but tuition grants from a local borough to the tune of $6,000 per year.
Yeah. North Slope Borough.
North Slope Borough.
That's a whole other subject.
That's another subject.
You know, I think though that
that's
we should
called the Alyeska contribution.
I just got back from there.
I think we clarify something though in terms of the tuition grant. Now we just made the statement that about $100 million goes to the university system, right? And about $3 million of that is actually tuitions. That $3 million is all the difference that's being made up from tuition equalization to AMU. Not the whole cost of the university. It's only their own equalized the tuition and what they charge their students. They still spend more than what they charge their students.
Oh, yes.
Whereas the University of Alaska, that $100 million versus $3 million is a fantastic price.
Well, wait a minute. You're taking the attitude as if two different functions. You know, the University of Alaska is doing research, for example, which is not being done by the AMU. It also has the public service function, which AMU does not perform. You know, there's a lot of things to be said against giving the AMU any money. You know, just simply buy them out and call it quits, solve the whole problem. You know, it's a strong case to be made for that.
Yes, but we like the university. They have a little challenge.
Sure, let somebody else come in here who can really maintain the challenge.
We can give a more challenge by funding four or five more here, so we got some real competition.
Yeah, I have no objection. If they pay their own way, fine. I'm just not too happy with the state subsidy, that's all. If they can make it against it, you know, that's fine. Let them go right here. God bless.
Private institutions can't make it anywhere without some help.
Yeah. Well, they are doing
not
it.
Not just here.
They are doing it.
But they really should just throw an antitrust
where are they?
I haven't heard of Harvard going out of business yet, to give you an example.
Harvard's got tremendous endowment. You know, I can't say that for most schools.
Well,
Harvard has the
greatest
endowment.
I think they probably do. I'm just guessing, but I'm sure they must be.
University of Southern California has more
endowment.
$1,400,000,000. They got an advantage over AMU.
USC is still in business, that's right. In fact, they're doing fine.
To raise $40 million a year. about 25 of which go into their operating budget, so even with their endowment, they don't make it unless they raise a certain amount of money to gift every year.
Okay, now, we've disposed of Harvard, and I want to get down to the budget, our own budget, we're out of money.
Before you leave that, leave that area, just let me make a short suggestion. On item 3, where we call it student loans, student tuition grants, two-year residency, instead of alerting everybody who touches it to the argument about the two-year residency, 30-day residency, and all that baloney, why don't you change the heading of the thought to resident student loans and student tuition grants. And then if we presently have it 2 years, let's not trifle with it until such time as somebody sues us. If
no.
It is more
no.
reasonable to be 1 year, make it that way, but don't put
that's,
the 2 year out on our sleeve.
This is our little outline,
no,
this in-house stuff.
I know, but
here,
we, nevertheless, we have a tendency when we start talking about residency, the first thing we get on is, we say 5-year residency or 3-year residency. Well, we talk about residency, and then the kind of slide the time.
We're sliding right over that because we're leaving it up to the committee
that's what
that
I was.
And be assured, we won't list it that way.
Huh?
We will not list it that way.
This might be easy. You might get over one roadblock to start with. All committees and all commissions end up working the same as far as getting the hang-ups we get into.
Okay, on our budget, and I will dispose of this very quickly. Oh, we've practically run out of traveling per diem money, as Herb.
You are now out.
We are out. You mean down to zero?
Maybe $5.
at least we aren't minus yet. But we have nothing left, so I guess I would have to request money when I go to our January meeting with the Legislative Council, because all we have left to do as far as traveling per diem would be to cover Southeast when we go to Juneau. And we may want to, I don't know if it's necessary to travel to Sitka and Ketchikan. Whenever we can work out some hearings, because Southeastern communities would like to have us have hearings.
Yeah.
From what Herb reports to me, there's been rather some demand for that.
Well,
our committee to have hearings down there, which we have that
after session starts?
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah, we're going to have to try to turn on that after session starts. So we'll try to work out that little detail, and what leads into Southeastern hearing schedule, and that'll take care of that. I hope that everybody will be able to make those whenever we work them out after the session starts.
Are you thinking in terms of Sitka and Ketchikan or one or what?
Well, we talked about this here in town, about the possibility of going to both, but we'll have to see what we can manage. There are such things as, pardon?
A weekend?
Oh, yeah, it would have to be.
The first 2 weekends of February, taking up with our commission and the Board of Regents.
Did your previous intern subcommittee, did they have hearings down in Southeast?
We did not go to Ketchikan, the only place in the United.
But you went to Sitka?
We went to Sitka, right.
So it was Juneau and Sitka that you covered. Well, we can talk about that and see how our finances hold up.
You pick the dry season and we'll go to Ketchikan.
The time we picked to go to Ketchikan, they were unable to have it.
You don't need a budget for that.
Now,
at that time, it was frowned upon.
Is everybody braced for tomorrow? We meet at 8:30 to 9:30 with the consortium group over in this auditorium.
Where is it at?
In the consortium auditorium.
In the library.
Yes, exactly.
8:30?
Yes, because the consortium people want to meet with us. They have some things they want to say. And then at 10 o'clock, we'll start our hearings.
In the same place.
In the same place. And we'll just take the witnesses as they line up. We have a list of them here.
You received a copy of the agenda for that consortium meeting, did you not?
Yes, I did.
Four items? Because I have one here that was sent to me.
Yeah, I don't think everybody's seen a copy of that. I have that somewhere. Would you read them, Helen, so everybody will know?
The relationship between the 1202 Commission and the consortium, the involvement of the consortium in the aborted merger between AMU and UAA, an overview of the consortium activities during the past academic year, and the role of the consortium in higher education in the Anchorage area in the future.
What was that thing about abortion?
The aborted merger between AMU and UAA.
Has it been aborted?
I know, I think they feel it was never aborting.
I thought the state paid its share.
So maybe we
I think it's been fought from the very beginning.
I predicted it was going to be aborted right after the check.
It's still operating. They talked about the consortium
meetings.
So Millie and Carrie will be there also.
Yeah. We will be there.
Okay.
I have one problem tomorrow. How much problems have you got on quorum? Are you riding on a variant?
Pretty tight. This is us, the four of us. They're all
us. Right, what is a quorum on this committee?
We have
any, you only have one senator. We don't count. So we haven't been counting whether they're senators or otherwise for quorum.
We don't need a quorum anyway, Julie, tomorrow, because we were simply a hearing.
Well,
we don't,
I suppose maybe in the morning, and the consortium didn't should probably do. The reason that I brought it up is that I'll come anywhere that you want me to form a quorum, but I'm scheduled two places at once, and in trying to help your transportation budget, I have charged the trip to the administration.
Thank you, Jeff.
That's a little complicated. If I don't attend there, I won't have to go there.
Well, we don't have to have a quorum for a hearing then, is that right? So it'll be...
And I think you're...
Especially if you're not reminded of the fact, I'd like to come over, I'll be willing to come in the morning and attend for a while, and then dash over there, and if you need me or something, It's over here in the court building, in the old court building, I think. It's AS-28. And I'd much sooner be with you, because that's the hardest work I've done yet, is fighting with all those lawyer types over AS-28 revision.
Is this a combined hearing of 1202?
No.
Would you be up there with...
But with the consortium, we're kind of meeting jointly.
The consortium asked us to attend, and I think they even want us to address some of these things. I don't know if they do or not.
I wouldn't be surprised, so...
Seriously, I'm a little surprised that they're worried about that, because they have the best working relationships they've ever had between you and the, at least between the administration and here's the one.
Why they chose a board of them?
Who is that
from?
That was
for Prince Rose.
Anchors
Alaska. Yes, he has.
Did you get that back?
Would you like to see it?
I'd like to see it.
Well, what's that mean?
All right, if there's no further business, we are
adjourned.
Catherine, what about these speakers and all that now? This is a question I should take.
My fourth contention, and perhaps the most serious, is that the university administration is making a mockery of the present grievance procedure. And I have numerous examples here. First of all, to acquaint you with the procedure, there's a step one and a step two hearing. Step one is generally heard by the dean or director of the respective campus. The way it's presently set up, a lot of the grievances are against decisions made by central administration. Therefore, it becomes very difficult for a dean or a director to overrule at the step one a decision made by their superiors. And so what we've found out is that there is no effectiveness at all at step one, even though that dean or director is perhaps the most knowledgeable person relative to the complaint or the grievance, because it's happened right there on his campus. They're his faculty, and he knows what's going on, yet he's not able to, not allowed to, resolve it. So we go to step two. Now, step two is unique in that in the less than 1 year that we have had this contract in existence, we've found that first, the provost was generally hearing step two grievances. Then that duty was assigned to Vice President Defoe. And most recently, it has changed for the third time to the contract manager, Carl Westman. Now, that's a unique situation in itself, when the contract manager now becomes the one to interpret the contract at a step two hearing. So I think that the way these steps have been functioning would clearly indicate that a mockery is being made out of the present system. One more point, and I think very important along the same line, is that recently, as recent as last week, a federal arbitrator was here from New York called for in the contract, or what are some of the...
How much time has actually been expended on the pursuit of agreements that come up since the contract was negotiated and was signed, at what time? What date, approximately?
It's about a year ago with our contract. See, we were out on strike in November, and we were called back in after that, and there was still some arbitration. So I'd say approximately a year ago we got our contract. Then it was retroactive. But it's only been, in actuality, about a year that that we've had the contract, although it goes back and covers a period prior to us actually having it.
Yeah, all I was curious about was what period of time has been spent on the grievances that have arisen since then, on these arbitrated grievances.
Oh, well, a good example, when the arbitrator arrived, we held hearings Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday of this past week, and the Wednesday hearing started at 9 in the morning, and I was still there at 5 o'clock Thursday morning. It went around the clock, almost made a 24-hour session just hearing. This was at the arbitration step. An extensive amount of time is being spent on these. And that's where I think a lot of the mockery comes in. Why have a grievance hearing at a step when that person is not allowed to make the decision at that step? I think a lot of the situations could have been resolved at step one had the administration authorized their deans and directors to make those decisions. That is not occurring.
Step three is the arbitration.
That is correct.
And then I understand you to say that the agreement on COLA payments was arbitrated.
That is correct.
And the result was what?
We do not have the written responses yet. I suspect they're forthcoming this week. He left on Thursday of last week and said he would be putting his his awards together as soon as possible.
But you don't know the findings.
That is correct. We do not.
And when will those be?
I would think this week. And we will certainly make them available to you.
If none of the other committee members are making any comments on this point, I would like to comment on your threat for autonomy, the word that you have picked out of the recommendations from the McLean report that almost labeled exactly that. But the committee, of course, is looking at the possibility of a separate structure for community college, but as you must understand, autonomy itself would mean, would almost require, in fact, a very, very well required constitutional amendment, which means, of course, that it would not be a simple procedure. Of course, the committee is looking quite closely at what arrangements might be made, because that would be a pretty dramatic change. And that's
what we've done overnight. Yes, we're very much aware of it, and we really thank your committee for the diligence that it's provided, I think, on the topic of higher education for the last year. We're very responsive to what your committee's doing.
Thank you very much. We're still running over time. We have one more to go this morning. We want it to be heard. That nicely.
I met nicely on the sociology faculty at the community college. The issue I want to bring up today before you is that on soft money programs, contracts, and this kind of thing that existed and do exist at the community college. And I try to make these first remarks very brief since I did try to cut down on the time. I think the first thing is that within the community college system, we respond to the needs of the community itself in terms of workshops, seminars, course offerings, and perhaps even eventually degree programs at the Associate Arts level. If the community interest warrants, I think this is the point then that we try to look in the available sources of monies, whether it's federal, state, private endowments, what have you, in terms of carrying on a degree program. And I think one of the examples I can give of that, we've done some work on the last 2 years as an associate in arts and chemical dependency counseling as part of the behavioral science program. There is, as I'm sure all of you are aware, a great need for alcoholism programs and other drug programs in Alaska. I think with alcoholism, our rate is 7 times the national average. So we've responded to this need within the community by developing courses at first, by developing a degree program aimed at training counselors in the field. But we've had one big problem with this whole thing, and that's money. So we're able to offer courses on a self-support basis. If we have enough students to pay for these courses, we're able to offer these courses if an organization such as the Center for Alcohol and Addiction Studies at the university is able to fund some of this. We also have the potential of getting money from the state office of alcoholism, that part of the program. But these are all examples of the kinds of things we can do. Interest courses in geriatrics we can offer on a self-support basis. So pretty much then, when we apply for a degree program itself, that takes care of courses, but for a degree program itself, when we apply for monies from the federal government or the state government, these are usually for a specified period of years, 3 years perhaps, or I believe the general run of the mill is sometimes 5 years, I go that high. But what happens at the end of, say, 2 years or at the end of 4 years when you have one more year to do everything that you need to do in order to get a program going on and so on? Well, I think in most cases the initial planning efforts have indicated an established need for a program, and that during the pilot period of this program, experience and refinement of the program, this in terms of the philosophy and the content is implemented. And we evaluate this as an ongoing process. But the crux of the problem then do become these final periods of funding. And I have a couple of questions there that I come up with. Within the university structure, are we planning well enough in advance to continue or to ensure the continuation of a program? Or are we at the last minute operating on a crisis basis that pretty much is what happened to the Association of Arts and Behavioral Sciences this fall? At the last moment, we found out that we were not going to be funded through Division of Family and Children's Services. So therefore, we were not able to offer courses to students already in the program unless we took an alternative, which in this case was working with students individually, getting them in to practical programs, for instance, through cooperative education. So we had to take these kinds of steps. Now, when we canceled all the courses, registration day, the question is, in my mind, is how many students might have signed up for these courses, were interested in pursuing the program, but not seeing it there at all, didn't know what direction to turn to. Another question I have is, once we began looking at a program in terms of needing to be self-supportive, self-sufficient, what happens in terms of university budget? Are these programs articulated? I believe that blue is a university budget document, but I've never seen one of these, and if I had a little more time, I might have availed myself of that to answer some of these questions. But I've had several faculty from various programs, soft money programs we call them, as well as my own experience, talking about these things. What does this do to the student? This is what we're here for, is these students, potential students, students from agencies, students who want to pursue careers that may have not had any experience. Okay, I think this whole idea of uncertainty of a program continuing seems to be the real problem. I don't know who's at fault with it at this point. I think it's something that is not just one person, one facet of the total structure from the university through the legislature. I don't know. But I think it deserves looking into. I think that one of the problems we have here is that we have so much trouble with new programs that all too often what we do is to use monies from one program to fund a position in another, and I'm not sure, but I thought I heard someone making a remark to the fact that my contract is on the Fairbanks campus. I might have been hearing things, and these leave serious questions. If someone's working in Anchorage, why is the money from a Fairbanks program, how we go back and forth like this? And for the first time today, I've never read this claim report. It's awfully thick, and I had about a half hour this morning. But I read page 2 of Ralph's report, and one of the encouraging things I've seen then is, particularly on page 2, under section 1 there, the second paragraph, particularly the endorsement of a separate and autonomous statewide community college system and these other things, seems to be maybe an alternative or a solution to some of the things I'm very much concerned about. I really do feel that the legislature should take a look at this whole concept of community college. Are we really meeting the express needs of the community, not only of local communities, but of the state? A lot of people, I'm sure probably even people here, feel that you need a PhD to work with people. And since I'm oriented towards social services, that's what I'll have to deal with. I personally don't feel this to be true. I would like to have a PhD myself, but I don't think I need it to relate to people. I think our associate in arts degree programs have been very effective. It's opened doors for career ladders and alcoholism and drug abuse correction in the outlying areas in program service aid positions. I think these things become significant. I think that when I ask the question, are the community colleges able to meet the expressed needs of the community, then I have to say at times it's marginal, that we are doing this to a certain extent, but not as much. We're not utilizing our full capacities. And I think that money seems to be the problem. I'm not so sure it would have to be. So I'm concerned, first of all, with the student, with those human services we could offer. And to get personal, then I have to be concerned with myself and other faculty members who, for example, I went on vacation for 3 weeks at the end of the summer, and I came back and found out I may not have a job. Well, when you teach, I think you are in a position where you need to make arrangements if you have to get another job with several months lead, not a week or two before a semester starts, for instance. So that kind of uncertainty of having to go to your students and not being able to meet their needs, which I think is paramount.
Thank you, Mr. Mason.
I have a kind of a problem here in terms of when we're talking about the autonomy. And I'm wondering, would your program, you know, teaching, fall in community college or would they fall in four-year college if a community college has had complete autonomy?
Representative Byrne, I think that's the question I can answer in two ways. Number one, I see in our catalog this year, it didn't come out that way, but the year before, my concept is that, first of all, you have people who want to terminate at the AA degree level. They're interested in learning basic human behavior, methods of working with people. Okay, I think that's great. But I think also we're in the unique position then with this structure where we've got to be able to offer that program at the AA level, but also not with just people going out from there and working with people and that's it, but also being able to transfer into those upper division programs. I will further respond by saying we do have a committee working on this of statewide faculty, myself, a couple of other community college people, and some senior college people. So I think that's a step in the right direction.
In your work, now, are you working with associate degree programs and students, or are you working on the first 2 years on a 2-2 basis? So your students now have the first 2 years of their 4 years?
Yes.
You're working on in both senior college and?
Well, the course I'm teaching are...
Either category, ACC.
Yes,
or,
right, yeah. Either category. I think that needs to be strengthened in a lot of areas.
I have the same question as Joe O'Connor. I'm a little confused as to what would happen with this autonomy. Does it mean that the traditional role of a community college was limited to some extent? And that some of you who are now community college instructors would automatically fall into a senior college or a four-year college category?
I feel this would be true. I must have to be honest with you.
Mr. Knight, if I understood you correctly, your basic concern is about the uncertainty of funding and the lack of clarity about it.
Well, the programs themselves, the programs, the various programs, it seems like money is the issue. You know, at the last moment we don't have money, therefore a program either is canceled, of course it's not offered.
That's what I said. The reason I ask that is, you know, what's said orally sometimes is forgotten pretty soon. What's in writing, you know, is what sticks around. And I noticed that they even got said that you were going to speak about how the administration manipulates federal money and misuses it. And that those much worried. And you haven't said that so far. You intend to say that what's here in writing, but you are just overly strong. I don't know which is intended.
Well, probably a little bit of both. I think the few comments I did make in terms of that was that sometimes we do have, well, let's take the money, behavioral science staff development program. It comes in, and I'm sure that some of the monies are used for other parts that are related, but not totally related to a specific program. I can't document anything right now. You know, it's just things over the 2.5 years that I've been here, where we've had, I use the concept, rob Peter, pay Paul.
You have some documented cases of the money being manipulated and misused. Those are the two words that you use, they're about the majority. So I'd like to know if there's some documentation that maybe you'd like to have.
Well, I think that if we looked at the contracts that we've had, federal programs and all this over the years, that I don't think this would have been a blatant type of thing. These actually weren't my words. Ralph wrote this up, and...
you aren't prepared to document that statement today?
No, not today, certainly. That's why I was a little concerned. I'd like to have more time today.
Thank you, Mr. Mason. Thank you. We have Virginia Del Piaz. Want to speak with us? What I shall do, and I don't mean to study group, press it on you, but I'm going to give the one minute signal when you have a minute left. But usually you miss that by that time, and of course, that was fine. So here I can give you a 1 minute signal, and then you'll know what time.
Okay. My name is Virginia Delphiaz, and I'm testifying for the Parks and Recreation Council today. And from what's been said thus far, I'm going to take an entirely different tack, completely different, as a matter of fact, from what has been discussed so far.
Excuse me, Virginia, these are the documents that you really distribute to all of us, so all of us have those that we can
do. I'll just read some brief excerpts from that in light of the time problem. The Anchorage area, there's a group of citizens that are vitally interested in the direction of land use and development at the University of Alaska Anchorage. This group is the Campus Park Task Force for the Parks and Recreation Council. This group is the Campus Park Task Force of the Parks and Recreation Council, PARC for short, which is a volunteer group that is actively working to preserve enough parkland in the Anchorage metropolitan area for recreation, wildlife habitat, environmental education, and aesthetic purposes. It's highly desirable when park proposals complement the other needs of the community, and therefore the task force has developed some conceptual proposals to establish a campus park area at the University of Alaska Anchorage. It will be capable of supporting a great variety of teaching, research, public service programs of statewide as well as local significance. We would like to see one of the largest remaining natural areas in the Anchorage Bowl left intact. We're making the irreparable error of breaking up this natural area and thereby eliminating a choice environmental study, physical education, and recreational area. We would hope you would consider some concepts that would integrate both community and university needs. And I'll just read through these briefly as you do have a copy to consider at your leisure. We have about five or six concepts here. We'd like to see the optimal physical, environmental, and educational carrying capacity of the University of Alaska Anchorage land, this determined, and then planned from there. The amount of land to be dedicated for higher education purposes and plans for its usage should be determined by the programs, which are anticipated to meet instructional, research, and public service needs. Projections of higher education needs in the Anchorage area indicate the state should establish a major university campus for extensive upper division undergraduate and graduate instruction, plus research and public service programs. In addition, several small community colleges offering lower division courses at locations convenient to Anchorage residents will eventually be needed. We feel the major building development at the University of Alaska Anchorage should proceed with what is called on the master plan the southward spine concept, or alternative number two. This we'll leave the land abutting Goose Lake and Northern Lights Boulevard in a natural and developed state, thus preserving an area for environmental study, trails, and open space. Several things need to be done in order to do this. just go through this briefly. One is acquiring what's commonly called the Rogers and Bandler property, which is between AMU and Tudor Road, on the next bond issue. Besides gaining this land for expansion, it would rid the medical, educational, recreational complex of an incompatible industrial use. Another suggestion is to trade lands owned by the university abutting Goose Lake and Northern Whites for AMU land south of University Drive. And this is indicated on the map that's attached to the letter there. A third concept, on-campus housing for the University of Alaska Anchorage, should be considered in order to accommodate students from outlying communities. This could help decrease traffic on campus if students did not have to commute. Also, students need close, relatively low-rent housing. And on-campus housing will be essential in developing what we consider a sense of university community. Four, the parking traffic problem, which is a very great problem on this campus, should not be the guiding planning force in developing